You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where despite prevailing research, keeping your cell phone in your pocket does help a horn grow. I'm your host, Justin M. Lesneski, and the horn is also in your pants, just like your pocket. It's a joke about your... All right, that was terrible, but unnecessarily... Blah, 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 blah. I can speak this morning. Sexualizing anatomy is relevant to the news this week. So why don't you tell a friend about your favorite podcast full of perverts? Speaking of, joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Speak for thyself, sir. I am a family man through and through.
This new gimmick that you've taken on 7 years into the podcast is boring AF. Can we go back to like 3 years ago before you were married and had a kid?
3 years ago before I was married and had a kid. No, I don't want to go back to that time. I have become the conservative that I feared I would become. Except that I'm also rational.
Also joining us from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. I'm successfully avoiding having a family, so maybe everyone should just choose the gay lifestyle, and then they don't have to be a boring conservative like Daniel.
I love how we found another spectrum on this show that I'm right in the middle of. I'm.
What is that supposed to mean?
That means Daniel's successfully having a family. You're successfully avoiding having a family, and I'm just over here successfully fucking up, being incapable of having a family.
And Justin's only giving hand jobs to dudes once in a while. That's what he's saying.
Whoa! I made this a gay joke, huh? I didn't sexualize this. Why'd you have to
right
sexualize
in the middle,
it?
Bisexual.
We need to consult our ethics department.
The Midside Ethics Department. There's just a sign on the door that says closed.
Perfect. Because it definitely would tell us not to do the news this week. But we're going to do it anyway. So on to the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Patreon, patreon.com/themidside. Patreon's a site that helps content creators like us make a few bucks every time we produce a piece of content because you, the listeners, can subscribe and say, hey, when you release a podcast, I'll give you a dollar. And that helps us keep the lights on. We appreciate our Patreon subscribers, patreon.com/themidside. CNN this week reminds us that it's Juneteenth. Juneteenth, if you're unfamiliar, is a celebration specifically of the end of slavery in the United States, but specifically June 19th, 1865. That's the day that Union Major General Gordon Granger rode into Galveston, Texas, and told slaves of their emancipation from slavery. CNN tells us that all but four U.S. states now celebrate Juneteenth as a holiday. So, apparently, African Americans and others mark Juneteenth, also called Emancipation Day, much like the 4th of July, with parties, picnics, and gatherings with family and friends. In 1980, Texas was the first state to make Juneteenth a state holiday, although it had been celebrated informally since 1865. But there is no national holiday yet. The U.S. Senate passed a resolution last year recognizing Juneteenth Independence Day as a national holiday, but it has not yet been approved by the House. The National Juneteenth Observance Foundation, an organization based in Mississippi, has worked for years to get Juneteenth recognized or observed as a national holiday. And, so Justin, what did you do to celebrate this Juneteenth?
I scratched my head and asked myself where the hell this came from.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, so am I the only person in the world who had never heard of Juneteenth? Like, I woke up and
that's your
I started seeing
privilege.
All these posts and I was like, what the fuck is Juneteenth? Look, two things. First of all, I'm all for celebrating this and making it a holiday, if not just because I get another day off work. No, I'm for celebrating this and making this a thing. But when did this happen? Did I miss this my entire? Am I just so white that I missed this my entire life?
A little bit. So, well, that's no, an interesting
I also
question.
Have another thing. I have another thing about that. Can we name this better?
Juneteenth?
Yeah, can we name it like Free People's Day or Fuck Slavery Day or something? Like, you know, Independence Day is like, yeah, independent. Like, we know what it is. But this is just like a portmanteau of June and 19th? Like,
well, it does
I don't
come
understand
from
this at all.
1865, when they were a little bit less clever about naming holidays. They didn't really have a big marketing presence in the United States in 1865. So,
yeah, but we can rename it now.
It's true. But what you could think of all the social justice-y names that it could be now. So I think Juneteenth is about as good as it's going to get.
So,
William,
I just need you guys to clarify. You guys have heard of this before?
No.
Well, that's what I was going to ask William. I have an answer to this question, but William, I'm curious if you, who are the only other white person on this podcast, have not heard of Juneteenth.
No, I have not. And in fact, when someone explained it to me, I was super confused because I don't know a lot of dates in history, but I do know that the 13th Amendment was adopted like in December 1865. I don't remember the exact date. And I also remember the Emancipation Proclamation was like, it was New Year's Day, like 1863 or something like that, that came out. So this seems like a particularly random date for those of you outside of Galveston, Texas, does it not?
What makes me feel like, William, it seems so random that it makes me feel like that joke from the South Park movie. Haven't you ever heard of the Emancipation Proclamation? I don't listen to hip hop. That's what I feel like. I feel like that guy.
Who, ironically, is a general. Right?
I have a question, though, too. I mean, again, I am not a history guy, so this is, like, super new to me that this is a thing. This general coming into Galveston, was he pointing out the Emancipation Proclamation or the fact that...
Yes.
Well, this was 1865, right?
So, yes. Granger
so
apparently
the,
read
the
to the crowd
amendment
that
was almost
the
adopted
proclamation,
by
then. Yes. In accordance with the proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This, of course, came more than 2 years after President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah, but we're like on the cusp of fully adopting the 13th Amendment at this point, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just super confused why this would be the commemorative holiday. I mean, in Galveston,
right, exactly.
It could make sense, right? Like, you know, we have local holidays. You know, my little hometown celebrates railroad days every year. And there has, other than the 60 freight trains that go through my small town every week, there hasn't been a huge railroad presence in like over 100 years.
And in Illinois, they have Casimir Pulaski Day to celebrate Justin's people.
Yeah. Eat kielbasa all day. But no,
I meant
William,
short
William
people.
William raises
but yes.
a point that I think is interesting for celebrating this day. Why do we celebrate it the last day that the immoral person got away with being immoral? Shouldn't we celebrate the day that the country recognized that this was immoral? Like, wouldn't it be better to celebrate the day the Emancipation Proclamation was made? Doesn't that make more sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's sort of, you could pick basically any day and just be the end of slavery day and celebrate it. If you want to tie it to something, fine. This does seem more local than national. And I say that because the paragraph in here says, African Americans and others mark Juneteenth much like the 4th of July with parties, picnics, and gatherings. Okay. I'm not white, so I don't have to play that card, but I do live in the richest minority-majority county in America, Prince George's County, Maryland. All of my neighbors are African-American. Basically, the entire community in which I live is African-American.
Were you having barbecues all day on June 19th?
No one here was celebrating anything on June 19th. It's not a thing, or if it is a thing, it is a much smaller thing than this article is making it out to be, and or I am still privileged in some way to not know that there are barbecues going on in my neighborhood. I just don't think this is as big of a thing as maybe they're trying to make it into a big thing. I just don't think it is that big of a thing in the African-American community if we have any African-American listeners, although I highly doubt it, please tweet at us at The Midside and let us know if we're really wrong and you do celebrate this all the time, and I will apologize to you on air. But
this is like,
so you're saying we're putting this in the same category as Kwanzaa?
Yeah, like there's a small group of people trying to make a big deal out of it, but most people are just trying to get on with their lives. Yeah.
It's like Mean Girls. It's like, Gretchen, you're not going to make Fetch happen.
Stop trying to make Juneteenth happen.
But Daniel, had you heard of it before this article in this year?
I have heard of it before this article in this year, yes.
When did you hear about it?
But it was, I mean, I heard about it in high school, but it was a matter of sort of like, this is something that was celebrated and now we don't really do that anymore, kind of thing. Like, I didn't know that people actively, and here's what I mean by celebrate. I don't mean observe it and go, yeah, this is an important moment in history. I mean, celebrate it like go have a picnic or a barbecue or light off fireworks or something. That's what I mean by celebrate.
I wonder if it has to do with region of the country, because I'm from the Northeast and William's from Detroit, not Detroit. Where in Michigan? Lansing?
Yeah, near Lansing, between Flint and Lansing.
Between Flint and Lansing. So between lack of water and water in Michigan is where William is from, if I'm to believe the media. But no, I wonder if it's area of the country.
I mean, it could be. You and I both lived in the South for 2 years. Never heard about this. I lived in Texas for a year during
June. I lived in the South for 4 years.
You lived in the South for 4 years. I lived there for two of those. Never heard of it. Lived in Texas, in Austin, which is not that far from Galveston. Never heard of it there. So I just don't know.
Honestly, the first time I saw this holiday was in our corporate calendar at work this year. I was like, what is this?
They updated their wokeness on the calendar.
Yeah. And that's the thing. How do you not become a conspiracy theorist? And what I mean by that is, is it really a coincidence that all of these groups and all of these companies and all of this media just suddenly started talking about Juneteenth all at the same time?
Well, it's because reparations are in the news, so we've got to drudge up old holidays.
I'm going to put a more benevolent spin on this, even though it doesn't deserve it. I mean, again, I'm not attacking the end of slavery for anyone out there. The nonsense holiday part of this. The benevolent spin I'll put on it is this is going to be America's next Cinco de Mayo, which is that Cinco de Mayo was a very localized holiday that no one outside of this of the city of Puebla, Mexico, really celebrated until Americans discovered it, and then they used it as an excuse to drink and wear sombreros. I feel like this is America's next Cinco de Mayo.
Yeah, which but is here's the difference, though, Dave.
Another reason to drink and wear sombreros. I don't know.
Well, right. I mean, that's a long history that goes all the way back to St. Patrick's Day, right? They're like, wait, there's a culture that has a day just to drink and we can do that?
I mean, that's, America.
Come on. Like, that's old. But here's the difference between Juneteenth, which is like, yay, individualism, end of slavery, which is amazing. So, hey, yeah. Look, I'm not for drinking, but if you're going to drink for something, you might as well drink for that. But the difference between that and the Cinco de Mayo is there's a huge irony of the Cinco de Mayo. Isn't Cinco de Mayo the celebration of that Mexican town kicking out foreign invaders from taking over their country and city?
Yes, a little bit. It's not exactly that, but that's pretty close.
But we celebrate Cinco de Mayo now?
Hilarious.
I'm just saying.
Well, Daniel, I have a question for you since you are not white and I live in a predominantly Latino neighborhood. What holidays are every day in June and July where there's fireworks going off? Because we're in that holiday season right now.
That's called preparing for Independence Day and then using up all the fireworks left over from Independence Day.
Well, my dog does not appreciate this holiday season, I'll tell you that.
We have the same thing everywhere, which is people start buying fireworks now, and then they're like, well, we've got these fireworks laying around. We'll just buy more. And so they get set off all of June, all of July, even into the beginning of August.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't selling fireworks technically illegal in most places in California?
I think you can buy them in Orange County, but you're not supposed to put them off in LA County outside or inside of the city. It's very weird. I think there's like unincorporated torrents where technically you can put off some fireworks, but definitely not the ones that they're putting off.
Yeah, the only place I've seen fireworks being sold is in the Anaheim area, and I thought it was just because there was a lot of Mexicans here that they made it legal here. And I was like, eh, all right.
Yes, well, speaking of fireworks, Harvard has caused some controversy. Harvard, you know that place, has caused some controversy as they rescinded an admission offer to a Parkland shooting survivor.
Yeah, Harvard, that's story... that's Michigan of the East, right? That's what...
If we had left the story there, people would be outraged and marching in the streets, but you dig a little deeper and you go, oh, okay, I get it. So Kyle Kashuv, I honestly don't know how to pronounce his name, so apologies, got the news that he'd been waiting for. He'd been admitted to Harvard, the Parkland shooting survivor, and here is where we start to dive into the, oh yeah, who had become a conservative rising star, had spent his senior year as a school safety and gun rights activist, traveling the country as the high school outreach director for the right-wing group Turning Point USA.
How dare he?
He planned to take a gap year before enrolling in the fall of 2020, but today Kashuv tweeted that Harvard had rescinded its offer in an apparent response to racist messages he had written years earlier. So apparently, in text messages and Google Docs from when he was 16, Kashuv allegedly used the N-word repeatedly, made crass remarks about women, and used other racist and anti-Semitic language. Why are we separating racist and anti-Semitic language? Anyway, okay.
Because the Jews are special.
Yeah, because one is a protected class and the other are evil.
We'll leave it for the audience to decide which is which.
That was funny.
A week after the messages first became public, he posted an apology on Twitter in regard to, quote, callous remarks he had made earlier in his high school career. The fallout from Kashuv's remarks ultimately led Harvard to write to Kashuv on June 3rd. I'm trying to make a new holiday.
Juneteenth? Are you sure it wasn't June on June 3rd?
saying, quote, after careful consideration, the committee voted to rescind your admission. So his apology went something like this. This is at least part of it. He said, quote, we were 16 years old, making idiotic comments, using callous and inflammatory language in an effort to be as extreme and shocking as possible. He says, I understand Harvard's concern over these offensive statements from my past, and I further understand that Harvard has been contacted about them by people expressing concern about them. While I will forever bear incredible shame for typing them, I especially feel remorse now that they've been made public, knowing that they have caused terrible pain to people I care about. He even pledged that during his gap year, he would supplement his activism to include reaching out to minority communities, but that was not enough for Harvard. Justin, 16-year-olds writing terribly horrible things sounds common to me. Am I missing something?
I mean, 36-year-olds writing terribly common or terribly offensive things is common. Wait, I probably shouldn't admit that live on air. But the greater issue to me is not that this is done privately, because there's a big difference between what you say privately to people you can trust and what you say publicly. And I don't mean that in people are dishonest publicly. And I don't mean that people, you know, believe something differently privately than they do publicly. What I mean is context. There's a much different context privately with people you've built up a rapport with and you have an understanding of communication with than people you go out and you meet and they don't know who you are and the way you communicate and the way you talk. So you can't be as free and open and as loose with what you're saying. I mean, it's even the difference between somebody who's been listening to us for 7 years and somebody who puts on this show for the first time. You have to have that delicate balance where you can't only talk on this show and produce the show for the people who have been here since the beginning, because then the newer people will have lost it. So the greater issue to me in this story is that somebody leaked this, right? Nobody is talking about this.
Yeah.
What about the morality of the person who was like, you know what? I want to fuck over this person's life. And they leaked it, and now this person's not going to Harvard anymore.
Well, and the timing is key here,
too. That, to me,
is
the real fucked up part of this story.
Yeah, the timing is key here, too. They waited until all the other offers had been rejected, right? Like, the timing now is sort of, like, too late to go anywhere else. So this is going to definitely delay him at least another semester from starting at any college.
Yeah, so my question for you, William, is certainly you're responsible for what you say in public, and you should be, in many ways, judged by what you decide to say in public. But we're now basically asking for the same level of scrutiny for what you're doing with your friends in what we consider to be a private space. Now, I know it's on the internet, and the adage is anything on the internet will eventually become public at some point. But this is a 16-year-old thinking he's talking amongst his friends. Now, my question for you is, one, is that standard fare? And two, does it make it worse? And what I mean is, does that mean he's being more honest about what he believes in that context?
I don't think so. I mean, it is common. I don't think it means that that's truly exposing the racism in his heart. Because otherwise, I mean, Justin's not my only Polish friend, by the way, with Polish heritage. The amount of Polish jokes I make to my other Polish friend would probably get me permanently banned from social media. But it's just funny. It's so opposite of my character, right? It's the juxtaposition that makes it hilarious. I'm not actually, this may come as a shock to Justin. I'm not actually racist against Polish people. So that juxtaposition actually makes it funny. So I think this comes down to the whole...
I mean, I don't tell Polish jokes because I've heard them all and they're so passe at this point. Yeah. Me. Like, I mean...
Well, Justin had pointed out the context thing, and I think that's so important. I think the other aspect of the context thing is, like, this is juvenile humor made by a juvenile, and this is worthy of, like, saying his character is not worth Harvard. Do you have the details there, Daniel, of his, like, I remember his GPA is, like, 11 to 12 or something ridiculous. His SAT scores are through the roof. He's, like, number 2 or 3 in his class. But, I mean, he said the N-word and made some crass jokes when he was 16. So, immediately, that means he is not Harvard material.
Yeah, so I have a couple of thoughts about this. One is, it's a private institution. Harvard, do whatever you want. Pick whoever you want for whatever reasons you want. No need to even cover it up with this moral integrity, whatever. And maybe it is your standard that you can never have said any negative thing ever in public or private in order to get into Harvard. Fine. Do whatever you want. But
so next year's currently... Harvard enrollment class will have 0 people in it?
If they were consistent. But look, you have people currently at Harvard, students and professors, mind you, who say worse things about people right now. It's just that they're people that Harvard doesn't care about, i.e. white people or Trump supporters or Republicans or libertarians
or Jews
or whatever you want, or Jews.
Yeah.
They're people that Harvard doesn't care about, yet they're students and faculty saying far worse or at least equivalently bad things about them. But Harvard doesn't care because they're not protected. They're not in the oppression Olympics. Now, the other thing here is Kyle, whatever, Kashuv, there's no need to go to Harvard. Like, I understand that it still has prestige because it's the word Harvard, but it's not the Harvard that won the prestige. It's not the Harvard that got it the reputation of being one of the greatest institutions of higher learning in the world. Harvard is a hellhole of intellectual waste. And there is no reason for anyone to go to Harvard for any reason anymore. You will not learn things. You will not make your life better. I don't even think you're necessarily going to get a quote-unquote better job because you went to Harvard. Potentially law school, but that's a different category of thing. For undergrad, Harvard is a cesspool, and there is no reason for anyone to go there ever.
Daniel, this point you just made, which is an excellent point, I was going to ask that, is like, why would you want to go to Harvard anyway? It actually goes to your first point, and it shows the overall issue with our culture now, where we're at with our culture right now, the point we're at with our culture right now, where his speaking like this with his friends is a more conservative way of speaking. And what I mean by that is, this comes from the whole idea of South Park, where South Park took the idea of making these over-the-top comments that are highly offensive to show that you don't believe it at all because it's so absurd. So it's absurdist humor. It's absurdist in saying, I'm going to say this thing that's so obviously ridiculous. It's so obviously something I wouldn't say or believe, and people think I believe it, so I'm going to say it just to point out how fucking absurd and stupid it is. And the right embrace that, especially the right youth embrace that, because of things like South Park making that part of the common culture. And that's the culture he was participating in. And that's, yeah. You know, as William is saying, his point about the juvenile way of speaking, that was his way of modulating it and trying to figure out, right? He's not as talented as Trey Parker or Matt Stone at 16 years old, obviously. And he's trying to figure out how to modulate it, whereas South Park has figured out over the years how to make it pitch perfect.
Yeah, I've always said that I love highbrow humor and lowbrow delivery, right? To me, that's hilarious. I've never let go of that more juvenile humor. I've just increase my standard for what they're poking fun at.
So you might you like mid-side humor.
Careful. To wait, say we have humor, on humor show? Is a stretch.
No, yeah. My point is...
We made the same joke!
My point is the combination of the highbrow and the lowbrow isn't something you would typically see together.
No.
Right? I had a t-shirt I loved. It was... Ain't no party like a Time Lord party, because a Time Lord party is not bound by typical temporal parameters and thus don't stop. To me, that's exactly what you just said, William. It's the combination of the highbrow and the lowbrow there.
Yeah.
I should never say this on air, but I will anyway. So I had a professor in undergrad who I was close with. She was a sort of raging liberal in the sort of old school liberal terms, you know, was not a social justice warrior type of liberal. She has passed away, but one of her things was studying white supremacy and actual like white supremacy, not the stuff that's called white supremacy. And she loved South Park for making that distinction. It was one of the pedagogies. She used South Park in the classroom all the time. Anyway, I bought her a shirt once from T-Shirt Hell that had the Pillsbury Doughboy on it doing the Sieg Heil, and underneath it said white flour. And she thought it was the greatest thing ever, and she used to wear it around campus.
Does that site even exist nowadays? Can it exist nowadays?
I don't know, but it was funny. Okay, so I want to say what you said in just a slightly different way, which is, I guess, my role on this show. You all make good points, and then I rant about them. So we've basically created a culture, not just for young people, but for everyone. We're having... one, quote unquote, honest discussions about race is impossible because we're not allowed to say things about race. And then certainly racial humor has become totally off limits to everyone, which is a shame. And that is bound to create a response in the youths, because that's what youths do, is they rebel. And they want to take things to the extreme. There's a reason why binge drinking is so bad as it is in the youth culture in America, because we're so puritanical about alcohol in the United States. And so, of course, young people latch on to these arbitrary, and they see them as arbitrary, rules about what we're allowed to say about race, either academically or comedically. And they want to push the boundaries. That is what youths do. And of course it's going to be ugly. It's ugly when they do with alcohol. It's ugly when they do with anything. But that is necessarily what they're going to do, because they're learning what it means to be an individual and make up your mind for yourself. And they're going to push the extremes. They're going to push the boundaries in every way. And if the culture lightened up about it and actually went back to having intellectually honest discussions about these things, it wouldn't be as big of a problem. Not that I think it is necessarily a problem, as big of a perceived problem.
Well, Daniel, I know you mentioned this, but I really want to touch on this because it's sort of like the elephant in the room. The blatant dishonesty about the reason why they are rejecting him or withdrawing his admission. I mean, they don't want him there, right? Like, just be honest about it. Like, this institution does not want someone who is pro-Second Amendment, pro-conservative, and smart, right? This is not the kind of citizens they want to create in the world, right? Just be honest about that.
Yeah, Totally. Just say we don't want conservatives, libertarians, we don't want people who believe in Second Amendment, whatever.
Yeah, you're a private institution. Just be honest about it. Say we're growing tomorrow's social justice warriors and just leave it at that.
Yeah. So, speaking about being honest about things, science. Here we go. So a new study says that the sexualization of female video game characters can lead to sexual harassment. So the article starts off by talking about, for decades, there's been a discussion about whether or not video games can translate into real-world violence, and there have been a number of peer-reviewed studies back and forth, one contradicting the other. While many researchers are focusing on video games and violence, others are focusing on something that's gotten much less attention, which is whether or not that sexualized female characters in games may influence the behavior of those who play them. So, a study conducted recently called Effects of Sexualized Video Games on Online Sexual Harassment had 211 participants play Ultra Street Fighter 4. And some of them were asked to play with characters who were females, who were extremely sexualized in their clothing and their being, and others were told to play the game with non-sexualized female characters. They did this by swapping out costumes. I've never played this game, so I assume there's lots of variants there. And after playing, here's where the study part comes in, participants were given the chance to send sexist jokes to a male or female partner. The researchers predicted that those who played Ultra Street Fighter 4 with sexualized female characters would be more likely to sexually harass female partners than those who didn't. The results showed that sexual harassment toward a female partner was more common for, quote, participants who played the game with sexualized female characters than compared to those who did not. These findings indicate that sexualization of female characters in a video game can be a sufficient condition to provoke online sexual harassment toward women. The researchers named two results from the study that surprised them. One is that more sexist jokes were actually sent to men than to women. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And then also that researchers found that female participants sent, quote, significantly more sexist jokes than male participants. Justin, aren't the two surprising elements of that study called you didn't prove what you set out to prove? Isn't that what that's called?
Well, that, and you obviously aren't in touch with reality. I mean, my first question is, the sexist jokes that are being sent between the men, are they sexist jokes about men or are they sexist jokes about women? That doesn't clarify. Oh, it sounded like you had a reaction to that.
No, I think it's an interesting point that they say sexist jokes, but we don't know sexist toward whom. I think the suppressed premise of the article is sexist toward women.
Right, that's a suppressed premise, but we don't
Wait,
know.
There's one other logical leap here that we got to point out. Wait, sexist jokes are automatically sexual harassment?
Yes. Right, I was going to say
we just jumped from so any sexist joke is automatically sexual harassment in the context of a study where they're told to send jokes.
Right, I want to put a pause on that for a second. I want to get back to that. I agree with that 100%. There's, again, the context point I want to make. But before I say that, the second point about women send more sexist jokes than men, and they send them to each other, right? Was that the second point of data?
It just says that a female participant sent significantly more sexist jokes than their male counterparts. It does not say to whom.
Okay, so forget the two part. But, I mean, this is one of those things you learn as a dude when you get older that you're told when you're younger. And it's not true, right? When you're younger, you're told that women are prim and proper and they don't speak and think the way men do. And they, especially that, oh, maybe it's part of the feminist culture. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it's a combination of the feminist culture and the puritanical culture. It's the idea that, oh, men are the ones who want sex like that. And they think about sex all the time and they're perverted in that way. And women don't. And, you know, I personally have had the problem, well, I say problem, quote unquote, because I'm not the kind of person that, like, I see someone who I think is physically attractive and I immediately think about what sex is like with her. I just, my mind doesn't work that way, right? My first thought is, oh, I wonder what that person is like, right? And I'm not saying that to virtue signal or anything. I've just never had that experience. But I've been told that that's the way men are, and women are the ones who don't talk about and think about sex all the time. But as you get older and you learn, or as I got older and I learned that women are actually more, quote-unquote, perverted when they talk amongst themselves, and they share more about sex among themselves. So you hear about locker room talk, but I've found that women's locker room talk is actually worse than males' locker room talk in the sense of they're more sexually explicit and they're more quote unquote perverted. So this, none of this study surprises me in that sense. And then as far as what William says, when you're talking about playing a video game and you're talking about online chatter with each other, whether it's through the headsets, whether it's through text, or if people are just texting each other afterwards, it's a different context. It's a desexualized context. So just like in the last story where these kids are pushing the boundaries of what they can say, they're playing a video game that has violence and quote-unquote sexualization in it, and they're in a desexualized environment and they're saying these things. It's not the same thing as how they would act in a sexualized environment or a sexual relationship, and we shouldn't conflate the two.
Yeah. So, William, let's dive into the huge hidden elephant premise in the room, which is that sending a quote sexist joke is the equivalent of sexual harassment. What say you about this?
Oh, this is a hard one to talk about, right? Because it's so politicized, and there's laws about unwanted sexual advances, right? If we're talking about sexual harassment in the workplace, which is what most people talk about, is a different context than when you're asked to send jokes to people in a study, right? Like, it's a totally different context, and to use sexual harassment in this context, it almost requires you to define what you mean in this study, right? Because sexual harassment involves a power dynamic and an unwantedness. And what's the power dynamic of you sending jokes as directed by the study? Like, the study moderator has all the power in this relationship, right?
Yeah. It seems tenuous at best to say that this necessarily leads to a sufficient condition to provoke sexual harassment. That seems ludicrous.
Also,
at best.
Also, isn't this study really only proving the mental priming hypothesis? In other words, if you put a bunch of sexual imagery up, that will prime your mind to, you know, find sexual jokes funny, right? If you, it's just an association, right? Like if I am talking all day about sushi, then I'm definitely more likely to eat sushi at night, right? For dinner.
Yes, I guess so.
This is why I was saying the context things, guys. Like, it's much different to be primed for finding sexual jokes funny and then to actually be in a sexual situation or actually be in a situation with a real-life member of the same or opposite or parallel or
perpendicular
whatever fucking gender identity you want to talk about, and act in a certain way. They're different leaps, and we shouldn't act like they're all the same.
But the concept that the over-sexualization of women in video games is harmful in some way is not a new concept, and in fact, it's getting renewed interest here. William, you'll probably know more about this than either Justin or I, but apparently the Final Fantasy VII remake, there's been some controversy with it because some of the scenes in the original game, like there was a cross-dressing event that they're making more modern, but then there's this gem from an interview. So this is a character. Her name is Tifa. So this is a quote. Quote, "We wanted Tifa to have abs, so she now has more of an athletic body type." The ethics department of Square Enix, who's the company who makes Final Fantasy, also said we had to tighten her chest so it doesn't look unnatural during all the intense fighting. Because of that, we added black underwear and tank top. So there is an ethics department at this video game debating the size of a fake character's boobs.
Yeah, basically they gave Tifa a sports bra is what it really comes down to. We're seeing this in lots of games. I don't remember the fighting game. I should have looked this up beforehand. But for one of the recent, I think it was Mortal Kombat, they basically took some of the female characters and made them like more clothed and almost like purposely more disgusting instead of being sort of like the more femme fatale sort of look. And a lot of people who really liked those characters were a little disappointed, right? Like, they're like, why are you making this more femme fatale fantasy and taking that away and replacing it with a more, I guess, PG version? But a lot of this has to do with, ironically, the globalization of games. I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but like to publish something like PUBG in Fortnite in China, you don't actually kill the characters. They like fall down and then wave at you and then apparate because, you know, we can't have like blood and stuff. And I think we covered the story a few months ago about turning some of the symbols around in certain horror games so that they were, you know, more like socially acceptable. So this doesn't surprise me at all.
I just feel like technology ruined all this to be that guy. Jokingly, I say we mandate that we go back to only the Atari system, and then it'll just be pixel blocks fighting each other, and we won't have to worry about any of this. There'll be no more blood. There'll be no more boobs. Just little pixel tanks shooting little pixels at each other, and we can all move on with our lives.
Yeah, well, just reasonable. Violence.
Justin, I have a question for you.
The patriarchy, Daniel, with the war and everything. Yeah, go ahead, William.
I have a question for you. So thinking back, like, let's compare it to movies. You know, in the 70s and 80s, you know, the only way to see boobs was to go get a Hustler magazine or a Playboy or something like that. Or you go see the latest B movie, right? I mean, that's the whole shtick of Mr. Skin and, you know, like, This was like the way, like that was like a marketing point. And now we live in a world, ironically, where, you know, you're one Google search away from any sort of depraved pornographic content you want. Yet we're like so puritanical in our art, which, like, you know, we sort of all agree here, video games can be art. We're so puritanical in and almost platonic and classicist in saying, like, well, women must be portrayed this way in our art. There's some sort of weird tension there.
Well, with movies, it's similar to what you're saying, where it's the globalization of movies has had the same effect, where a lot of movies are designed for the Chinese audience, the Chinese market in mind, because, I mean, if you even look at Avengers Endgame, it's not making most of its money. It didn't make most of its money in the U.S., right? It made it foreign. So that's in there as well. But yeah, I think platonic is the best way to put it. Things aren't being designed for the art itself. It's being designed for these philosophies or these ideas that are supposed to supersede the art. And they're supposed to just be given truths about the world or given truths about the culture. And the question isn't, you know, the integration department, right? How come Square Enix doesn't have an integration department where they say, and this might be a weird thing to focus on in there for a long time, but I could see this coming up. Why couldn't they be like, okay, did the breast sides of this character integrate into the overall artistic vision of this game rather than the ethics department? Why is it an ethics decision and it's not a artistic decision, not a aesthetic decision? And that's how I want to see the focus of all of this shift. We're too worried about, as you're saying, these platonic ideas of these religious ideas. I mean, this is the whole religious aspect of social justice, right? This is the most concerning thing about social justice taking over this culture.
I feel like this is an essay that Ayn Rand would approve of, boob size as romanticism.
Yeah, I think one of the commenters, I think, pointed out the naturalism here. It's like, oh, we're in a fantasy world, and people are saying that the boobs aren't bouncing realistically during battles.
Yeah.
Well, meanwhile, the male character is carrying like a 1,000-kilogram sword around, right?
I know Barrett has that big fucking machine gun arm, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, either his muscles should be, like, bigger than the rest of his body, or maybe we should be approaching boob physics like Justin says and saying, does it integrate with the themes of the game?
Right. But I have a question for you about the fantasy thing, right? How is it like Final Fantasy VIII? Isn't it the Final Fantasy? I don't understand.
That just feels like a bad translation thing to me. Like, is Adam Carolla once seeing a fight game translated to violence fight. So, I don't know.
That didn't answer my question. Is it a bad translation, William?
No, I think it makes sense. I'll have to see what the Japanese word is, but final doesn't have to mean last, right? It can be like penultimate, right? Maybe it's more like penultimate fantasy.
See, bad translation. Okay, let's end this week on a positive note. The U.S. suicide rate is up 33% since 1999.
You were
research
just,
says.
Your admission to Harvard was just rescinded for that joke.
Rescinded.
Good. They can keep it. So yeah, the 2017 rate, which is the last year we have numbers, was 33% higher than in 1999. Suicide rates among people 15 to 64 increased significantly during that period, rising from 10.5 per 100,000 people in 1999 to 14 per 100,000 people in 2017. The report noted that America's suicide rates are at the highest level since World War II. Those who identify as American Indian or Alaskan Natives had the highest increase among all race and ethnicity groups, according to the research. The research is conducted by the National Vital Statistics Systems and shows that the suicide deaths among girls and women rose significantly for all racial
and ethnic groups. Did George Orwell name that group?
It's hilarious, isn't it? What was that? The suicide death rates among girls and women rose significantly for all racial and ethnic groups except Asian or Pacific Islander.
That's my favorite part of the entire story.
And the largest increase was among American Indian or Alaskan Native girls at 139% increase. Among boys and men, suicide rates increased significantly for all racial and ethnic groups except for Asian or Pacific Islander, with the largest increase observed among American Indian or Alaskan Native boys at 71%. The researchers want to note that it has some limitations, including that deaths can be misclassified and that deaths among American Indian, Alaskan Native, Asian, Pacific Islander, and Hispanic people may be misclassified to other races and ethnicity groups. Justin, why are people killing themselves?
The Asians aren't just misclassified because it's so shameful to commit suicide that they say it's something else even though it was suicide.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
No, I mean, I just look, that's my favorite part of the story because I find it interesting is the why are Asians killing themselves less than everyone else? Can someone study that? That's just so interesting to me. Well, what was your question?
Why are people killing themselves more?
Oh, well, I think the people in Alaska are killing themselves because of globalization. And what I mean by that is they're like, wait, we don't have to live in fucking Alaska. And then when they realize they're stuck in Alaska, they're just like, fuck this. There aren't even any black people in Alaska. Alaska? There are no black people in Alaska. That's a really old reference if anyone wants to.
It seems now. Okay, so there's a map here. William, you can respond to this part if you want or take it in a more intellectual direction. If you look at this map.
I was going to talk more. I love how you interrupt me like I don't get to finish being intellectual. Like, fine.
Yeah, you made your Asian jokes and we're moving on. So if you look at this map where suicide has increased the most. And in fact, the state where it's increased the most is 58% increase in North Dakota. It is predominantly states that are cold. And if you look at the coast states and the states that are warm, there is a much less increase. There's still a slight increase, but it increases less dramatically.
See, so it, you dismiss it, me like I wasn't intellectual, but it's a valid observation.
Is the increase here weather-related?
I don't know. Should we count this among climate-related deaths? Are you blaming global warming on this, or the lack
well,
of global
no.
warming?
Yes. I'm actually thinking that global warming it would be a good thing for suicide rates, apparently. We need to look at other warm countries versus cold countries, because from this map, I would draw the conclusion that if you don't want a chance at killing yourself, move to somewhere that's warm other than Louisiana.
Yeah. Look, isn't this why Russia is the way Russia is? Because it's so fucking cold. I thought this was a foregone conclusion in the world, that this is why Russia was the way Russia is.
That people kill themselves where it's cold?
Yeah, why do Russians drink so fucking much?
Because there's nothing else to do?
Because it's fucking freezing, too. Dude, in the top deck of Gillette Stadium in a playoff game, seen this when you went to the playoff game against Tennessee, where it was fucking freezing?
Yeah, it was so cold that my muscles were moving involuntarily to basically stay alive.
Right. Haven't you ever heard did you hear any of the people in there say they're going to go get some antifreeze? Because that's how they stay warm, they just get drunk?
Yeah, ironically, it doesn't really help. It only makes you feel like you're warmer, but you're not actually warmer.
I think
that's the point. You just summed up Russia.
Yes. I think do you have anything else to say about this?
Yeah. Well, first of all, on the map, I think we should overlay that map with the opioid crisis map. And I think we'll see a surprising overlap there in the suicide rate.
That's interesting.
And the second thing is, and I know this is going to make great pod, but I posted two graphs from the study because, you know, I hate these hot takes from CNN that bury the lead. I actually read the study and I put two graphs on there and I'm going to describe it. While I'm describing it, I want you, the two co-hosts, to take a look and tell me which one's the male graph and which one's the female graph. So I'm looking at a graph that shows the change in suicide rate from 1999 to 2017 amongst different ethnic groups. And let's say the highest for one of these, the jump was from 4.6 to 11.0 deaths per 100,000, which is a huge, significant increase. And then the other one, the highest one, is from around 20 per 100,000 all the way up to 33.8, so almost 34 per 100,000. So looking at this graph, gentlemen, which one's the male one and which one's the female one?
Now, do you want me to guess based on reality or guess on being woke?
Yeah. Guess based on reality.
On reality, it's the one where the numbers are all much higher. Yeah. Shockingly higher.
Shockingly higher. The baseline is higher and the increase is even more shocking. So
isn't that an issue here of visual rhetoric? I mean, why are these graphs designed to look the same when the numbers aren't the same?
The scale is fucked up on these graphs. Just to give people context, we'll copy pasta these into the show notes, but the scale for the female one only goes into, I do it all the time. I'm a producer. It goes all the way up to 12 for the female one, but it goes up to 40 for the male one. So you look at this graph and you say, wow, there's a shocking increase in the female suicide rate. When really the story is here, holy shit, we have a male suicide crisis that is only getting worse and is spreading slowly to the female population. So talk about bearing the lead in this story.
Yeah, well, you can't do an article that, you know, bad things are happening to men, because then all the social justice idiots will come into the comments and say, yeah, but women too. Don't you remember that there's lots of stuff like that, but the one we covered in the show where it was like this article that had a picture and it was like a full 25% of homeless people are women.
Yeah, I was going to say that too.
Wow.
It's the picture.
Wait a minute.
The three flat men or the four flat men. And it says one in four. Did you know one in four women are homeless? And then someone replied to it and it's a meme now. That's an interesting way to say that 75% of homeless people are men.
Yeah. It's all part of the male disposability stuff.
Yeah, maybe
right?
maybe I'm biased, you know, as I know I'm identifying as female for the podcast, but as a gay man, I want lots of healthy, men in the world, right? And the fact that possibly attractive and if addressing their mental needs, otherwise healthy men are killing themselves. This is just not a world I want to live in.
Lots of
well, don't you think, William, that's why the female suicide rate is starting to creep up? If all the good men are killing themselves.
Oh, boy. We're going to get in so much trouble about this article. It's fine, though.
Are we? Are we?
Well, our take on it is a little interesting.
Hey, people, stop killing yourselves. Is that a better take? Like,
sure.
Life is valuable. Don't kill yourself.
Yes. Always good to make fun of suicide. And I know I started it, but...
I'm not making fun of suicide. This is very serious.
Yeah, to be clear, this is... We're not making fun of suicide. We're making fun of this woke take on it, which is completely ignoring the facts presented in the article. Or in the actual
paper.
And I
would argue the wokeness is what's causing the suicides. All you're doing is telling people everyone is terrible and life is suffering. Of course they're going to fucking kill themselves.
Now, let's have a fun woke take on these stats for just one more second. Look at the white suicide rate compared to the black suicide rate. White people kill themselves twice as... White men kill themselves twice as much as black men?
This is crazy. I mean,
I don't know.
I think I would need
this as a social justice warrior and saying, "Good, down with the white patriarchy."
Yeah, I think we would need to understand this in terms of murder rate as well, right? Because we know the murder rate among blacks is higher. Black on black crime is very, very high compared to other crime statistics.
Well, if they're all killing themselves,
exactly.
Of course, black on black crime is higher.
They may not be suicides, but they may be killing each other, and this may be the same pathology expressing itself in different ways.
Yourself?
We're going down roads now that are very uncomfortable for me. Last note from the show, from the news, is that there was only one state that decreased its suicide rate from 1999 to 2017. Did anyone notice what state that is?
Florida. I'm hoping.
No.
Oh.
Nevada.
Well, yeah, it's just because you go to Vegas.
The land of hedonism.
Yeah.
And heat.
Lots so of you're heat saying brothels decrease suicide.
Look, I'm not saying it. The data is saying it. Thank you. You're welcome.
That might be the best argument for moving to Nevada I've ever heard. Also, no state income tax.
There you go.
But speaking of
things
that make you uncomfortable... I'm going to review Toy Story 4 in the Hope for Romantic with JML.
Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off. Wasn't focused on.
If you have not yet joined our Discord channel, I can't talk today.
Oh,
our Discord
God,
channel.
Man.
You should. It's this fucking retainer. Maybe I should take it out when I'm recording the podcast. But it's like the more I talk with it, the less of a lisp I have with it. So I'm trying to like really get used to it. No, if you haven't joined our Discord, you should, because when you are in there, you will see me be peer pressured by the Midsiders into watching certain things. Like a couple months ago, I watched Chocolat. Now on my docket is Chernobyl because I've been told how great that is. I hope that doesn't suck as much as Chocolat did. I just pissed off half the audience, but whatever. No, but seriously, I appreciate it. I appreciate the recommendations. I appreciate seeing things I normally wouldn't see. And honestly, I probably wouldn't check out Chernobyl if everyone didn't tell me it was worth checking out. And you know what actually makes me want to check it out more? The fact that you all in Discord said it's worth watching, especially because of what people are saying about the science. People are complaining that the science isn't real, and they're missing the point about the theme of the show. The motifs of the show, the ideas of the show. And that makes me go, hey, this is probably pretty good romanticism. And the fact that you all are in there pointing that out, that makes me want to see it. And you know what? It gives me a swell of pride and joy because that's why I made this show. And that fact that we have a little niche community helping each other out with this stuff, thank you. So I think joining Discord is worth it for that reason.
It warms the cockles of your heart.
Well, I would have just ended with the first part of one of those words. But also, if you went to themidside.com last week, you'll see that I'm going to start now doing written reviews of any movie or show that I review on the show. So last week, I thought that was a pretty good review of Shaft that I wrote up there. So if you want to watch that. And likewise, after we record this show, I'm going to get off and I'm going to write my review of Toy Story 4. Because that's what I want to talk about this week is Toy Story 4.
Is the getting off required before you write the review?
You have an interesting writing technique.
I mean, everyone has their process.
It's how I focus.
Okay.
Otherwise, I get distracted. I mean, you know.
It is a children's movie, though.
Yeah,
but there was a weird sexual undertone to this whole children's movie. It was very bizarre.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I mean, the villain was basically an incel. It was very, very weird. But before we get to that, I want to ask you guys how you would rank the Toy Story movies, the first three. And second question, do you feel like these movies are getting weirder? Go.
You try pick someone so we don't speak at the same time.
Okay. William, go first, and then Daniel, go second, because Daniel's the animation Pixar guy.
I loved Toy Story 1, but I think I liked Toy Story 2 slightly better. And then I would put it 2, 1, 3, but it's really hard for me to put 2 over 1, but that's how I'd rank them.
Not hard for me. It's 2, 3, 1, in my opinion. 2 is knocks it out of the park. 3 is such a more complex, rich, interesting story. And 1 is just so groundbreaking. But it's not bad. I mean, 2, 3, 1 in a series of all tremendous movies. I don't think they're getting weirder, Justin. I think they're getting more existential.
Yeah, I would agree they're getting more existential, and that's definitely clear in this one. And apparently I'm a fucking weirdo because I would rank them 3-1-2.
No. Really?
I mean, I just think...
Two is the worst of them?
Yeah. Two is the least interesting to me.
Wow.
One is good. Like you said, it's groundbreaking. It has all the original stuff in it. And two, it doesn't interest me as much. It's small scale. It's just not as good. And three, I think is, how could three not be number one, guys? It's tremendous.
It's good. It's a little dark. It's a little dark.
What is dark? And this one's a little dark too. And that's what I mean about getting weirder. Okay. So did you think the baby was creepy in three?
Creepy?
Yes.
I don't know about creepy. I don't know about creepy.
Okay.
It's fine.
All right. Well, I thought the baby was creepy. And there are these weird... Did you ever watch Goosebumps, Night of the Living Dummy?
Yes.
They have dummies in this one that are so fucking creepy. It's like a horror movie.
It's based off of a real life thing.
100% it is.
Charlie? Is that his name? Anyway, someone can look that up.
It's based off of something like that. So just to say my rankings, I would rank this just above number two. So I would have 3-1-4-2. So that gives you an idea of where I'm coming from with this.
No matter what, you'll be wrong. Got it.
Yes, I guess. I mean, okay. I'm still confused as to how people think two is the best movie. I'm dumbfounded by this. I mean, three is so phenomenal. I watched two and three again to get ready for this. And just three is so far above the other two. I just don't, like, the storyline is complex, the emotionality of it, especially at the end. I mean, Barbie's line gets me every time. It's just an amazing movie. I mean, the moment where they're going down into the fire and they're ready to die, and then the aliens come in, that's just so well written. And then the ending where Andy gives the toys to Bonnie, it's just, every note in that movie is perfect. It's perfectly integrated. It's perfectly done. I think that's one of the best movies ever made. That's how strongly I feel and how well I think of number three.
So tell me about number four. Stop teasing me.
Okay. Number four. So number two had the direction of the Lost Toys, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Number four takes that and goes even more to the extreme with that. The whole idea is Bonnie's going on vacation. She makes this toy Forky. Forky weirdly wants to continue to, like, commit suicide. It's very strange. Like, he keeps going trash and jumping back into the trash because he thinks he's trash. It's very strange. But at a certain point, he jumps out of the RV. And then Woody jumps out of the RV with Forky because he doesn't want Forky to be lost. But the whole time, the whole movie, they are lost toys. And they run into Bo Peep, who is also lost. And the whole story is about Woody coming to terms with what it means to be a lost toy or not, and deciding if he wants to be a lost toy or not. No, I'm not gonna spoil the movie, but when you watch the beginning, it's very obvious where the movie's going. You'll know where it's going almost immediately. But there were good things about it. Like, I appreciated things about it, but at the same time, I was just like, this. After three, this entire movie felt unnecessary. Like, the very end felt like a goodbye and an end of Toy Story, but number three felt like a better end of Toy Story. It just felt like this was just like, I like what they did with it. It was creative to keep the movie series going, and I can't, as a standalone movie, I can't really knock it in that sense. I can't really be like, oh, that was bad, but the whole thing felt unnecessary, and a lot of the elements in it felt very almost forced because of it. Forky feels like a MacGuffin. They even make the MacGuffin joke in the end credits scene. So it was only like he was created in order to force this whole plot with Woody. And then the Key and Peele characters, I mean, they're just following around the whole movie. They serve no purpose, it seems like. I will say, though, the Keanu Reeves character, Duke Kaboom, was excellent. He was hilarious. Keanu knocked it out of the park with that. And then the villain. So they end up in this antique shop. It really felt like the Orange Circle in Orange, California. I was like, wow, they must have modeled it after that. And also, the whole thing takes place in a carnival in this town. And I was like, they had to have done this with Pixar Pier in mind. It was very almost obvious. But they're in this antique shop. And in the antique shop is this doll, Gabby Gabby, whose voice box has been broken since she came out of the package. So she's trying to steal Woody's voice box because she believes that if she wasn't born broken, then a kid could have loved her and she could have fulfilled the toy's true purpose. And the only thing keeping her from that is the fact that she was born broken. And it's just like, wow, this is like a weird incel undercurrent to this movie. And that's what I mean about these movies getting weird and like weirdly sexualized. There's this whole thing of like, well, I only have my one kid and my one kid is who I'm supposed to be loyal to. And it's just like these undertones of these movies are getting weirder and weirder. And I mean, Daniel, like, I think existential is a better way of saying it. And if they continue this series, I don't know where it's going to go. So look, you should see this movie if you enjoy the Toy Story series and you just want to see where this continues to go. You're not going to be totally upset. The only thing you might get a little bit upset at is Bo Peep comes across as a stronger character than Woody does. And there's a point where they do the whole social justice thing where she tells him to just shut up and follow, and he doesn't shut up and follow. He just goes head on, straight in, without thinking. And it's supposed to portray the idea that men don't think and women think, and you're supposed to follow women. You know, the whole typical thing. So it's definitely the most social justice of a Toy Story movie. So it's kind of interesting to see through the eras Toy Story evolve in that way. You shouldn't see it if you're just going to be like, I'm sick of this, there's too much of this. To me, this is almost to that point where it's like, there's too much Toy Story, this needs to end. Like, if there's a fifth one, I might just be like, okay, I'm done with this. I don't need any more Toy Story, because this movie was almost on that verge. And then finally, Daniel, speaking of the animation, I'm no animation expert, but I want to ask your opinion on this. Watching the animation evolve, right? When you watch three, it looks a lot different from one. What do you think of that?
What do you mean, what do I think of it in terms of aesthetic integration, or
right?
I get it. I don't think the way one looks is a necessary element of the storytelling. I just think that's where the technology was at the time. So I think you could in some ways outpace yourself, meaning you could choose an aesthetic that ruins sort of the internal continuity. But I think everything just looks sort of a better version of itself and doesn't look like a completely different style.
Right. So with three, I agreed with what you were saying, where the whole time I was like, okay, this is just the technology's better, so they're making it look better. But with four, William, it's almost, they're almost in the uncanny valley now. And what I mean by that is it almost looks so real that it's fake. I mean, there's a cat in the movie that at certain points I was like, is that a real fucking cat? Like, it was very strange. And then the thing that really bugs me about this movie that I don't remember in the first three is they had this weird shininess and shine coming off of all the toys' faces. And it just was very distracting to me. And I didn't think it was a necessary aesthetic element.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's always a danger when you're trying to improve animation. We see this a lot in video games. You know, some people will play old video games and say, oh, these graphics don't hold up. But at the same time, you'll see certain games that, you know, rub up against that uncanny valley thing and actually will take you out of the suspension of disbelief. So I guess if it makes sense that that would be a danger, and it is unfortunate if that took you out of the movie, because, you know, you look at something like Up, right, where the animation is stylized and beautiful, but still realistic, right? Like, it's not completely cartoonish, right? And there's ways to do that. You know, I think of, like, Mononoke Hime as another one of those, Princess Mononoke, where the animation is done, there's some fantastical elements, but the facial expressions and things like that aren't crazy over the top. But you can go wrong the other direction, right? You can make it try to be too realistic. And I see that a lot in story mode for some of the AAA games that are out there, where they're doing facial capture of actors, but then not really styling much on top of that, right? They end up quickly getting into that uncanny valley.
Yeah, and that was how I reacted to the animation in this movie. Largely, it unfortunately took me out of it. So, all right, well, that sums up Toy Story 4. Go ahead, Daniel.
Last minor comment. The Pixar series that handled this the best, I thought, was The Incredibles. With the huge time span between the two, they didn't make Incredibles 2, although the technology had advanced so far, it looked very similar. It just had more rich detail to it without being... Without committing what Edward Tufte would call a pridefully obvious presentation.
What I would say about Toy Story 4 is it had that pridefully obvious presentation. I mean, just sometimes when Woody was walking around, I was like, it's weird. I know the dolls were supposed to be creepy, but Woody was almost creepy at certain times. It was almost like he's not supposed to be alive. Whereas the older animation Toy Story worked because it was like, you believed that these dolls could be alive and that this wasn't just falsely animating something as alive that wasn't animated before.
I think what they need to be careful of if they're going to continue down this path is to not forget that they are toys. They're not people, right? They're alive toys. They're not alive. Woody is not a human. So to make him too human gets weird.
Oh, and yeah, and that reminds me of the other element that was really off-putting of this movie. In the beginning, they remembered that. So there was a lot of logic and attention paid to how the toys were when people weren't around, so that when people came back, the toys were in the same place where it was easy for them to, you know, Andy's coming. So they just, you know, pretended they weren't alive again. In this movie, these toys are running around when there are people everywhere. Like, in the fair, they're, like, shooting zip cords over the fair. Like, I'm hyper-vigilant, dude. If there's fucking toys on a fucking zip cord over the fair, I'm going to see that shit. And then, like, there are many times in the movie where, like, the humans think they've lost the toys because the toys are getting up and running around when the humans aren't there. And then they don't know where the toys are when they come back, and they think they just misplaced them. But it's because the toys are moving around. And then there's one part in the movie where the toys literally influence the events of human life beyond, like, how they shape a child through emotional connection and creating happy memories. They literally take control of human life by directly interacting with the humans.
Toy Story 9, Nietzsche's Toy Box.
Yeah, it's... So that was the other thing. So yeah, I think that's a good point, Daniel. They might be forgetting the original premise, which, I mean, that's what happens in all of these, right? And that was actually something I thought about when I was watching. It's sort of like when you watch Saw 4 versus the first three Saws. It's just like they're trying to keep Jigsaw alive so much that they're doing so many screwy things with the premise that you're like, this isn't even what originally Saw was about. Toy Story is sort of going down that path, and maybe it's something we can call franchise creep or sequel creep.
What other podcast would draw a line between Toy Story 4 and Saw?
I'm waiting for the crossover event.
I mean, it writes itself. Do you want to play a game?
So play nice.
All right, let's go forward to Trailer Takedown here. As always, the trailers are posted on the website, usually the Saturday before the episode premieres. You can go to themidside.com/podcast, and you can watch those trailers during the episode, after the episode, before the episode, whenever you feel like it. Some people like to interlace them so they know exactly what the fuck we're talking about, even though we don't know what the fuck we're talking about. But let's head into it. Veronica Mars Season 4 is the inevitable reboot of Veronica Mars on Hulu. I say inevitable because it seems like everything's fucking being rebooted nowadays. I can't remember, but there was something else I saw.
There was even a reboot.
Was there?
Yes.
I missed the reboot of reboot, which is ironic because everyone missed reboot, so of course they'd miss the reboot of reboot. When did this happen?
I think it may have already been canceled, but there was a reboot of it. I'll find it.
How do you not know the reboot of reboot is going to get canceled? Like, isn't that like one of the most obvious things ever? Like, why would you even try that?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I know what it was. There was a trailer for the Addams Family animated movie before Toy Story 4. Do we need an? I was literally sitting there watching the whole trailer going, do we need an animated reboot of this? Are we really all the way down to rebooting the Addams Family?
Yeah.
Anyway, as far as this goes, look, I'm going to see this. I watched the first three seasons of Veronica Mars plus the movie. I like Kristen Bell's Veronica Mars. This is the role she was born to play. I'm interested to see how this holds up or changes in today's culture because Veronica Mars is based on Orange County, California. So now, especially now that I live here, I want to see what they do it. She's going back to Neptune, which is based, I'm assuming, on Newport. And there's all a lot of stuff about the haves and have-nots in all of this. So I'm interested to see what they do with this, to see if it holds up, to see if it's better. So I'm not going to lie and pretend like I'm not going to watch it. I'm assuming this is going to be terrible, but I'm going to give it a chance. Hug. Daniel?
Reboot's already out, and I didn't even hug that, so why the hell would I hug this? I've never watched any Veronica Mars at all. This trailer looked like an atrocity. Of a film that I guess it was a bunch of in-jokes or something. I have no idea, but it made very little sense to me. And why terrorists would target this very small town and have very complex bombs that go around people's necks made no sense to me. Her character seemed terrible. All around, awful. Tackle.
Yeah, it was a bunch of in-jokes, Daniel. And that is part of the show, is it's very pulpy in the sense that all of these absurd things happen in this small town. But that's what I mean, a part of the commentary of it and part of the whole idea that's based on Orange County. So, but I agree. It's very over the top, but it's always been that way. William?
I also will not be watching the Murder, She Wrote remake.
Tackle.
I would actually much rather watch a Murder, She Wrote reboot, as long as it starred Angela Lansbury.
Is she still alive? She's going to be like 110 at this point, doesn't she?
She's 141, and she's still going strong. Now you shut your mouth.
Hey, long live Angela Lansbury, right? If we had to have a queen, we could make it her, right?
Absolutely.
Second trailer.
On Becoming a God in Central Florida is the inevitable Kirsten Dunst TV project. I say that because doesn't it seem like every actor who's like run out of a movie career is just like, I'll do a series. So it's on Showtime, and I put this in here because I was interested to see what was going to happen because it's like based around the Orlando area. That's why it's Central Florida. And this trailer itself, I sort of got a romantic vibe from it when they were talking about like, you know, what people think about how to make it and how to survive and how to be happy. But then the shooting style seemed very naturalistic. So I don't know. There wasn't, unfortunately, this trailer needed to be more. It was more of a teaser. But I think this will probably be very negative because it's about Florida. We know the media loves to bash Florida. So tackle.
Tackle?
That's a good tackle, yeah.
It just looks so low production quality that I wasn't particularly interested. Now, the voiceover about how luck isn't really a thing, it's sort of what you make of your life, that's very cool to hear. It's purpose, you know, it has to deal with your purpose and going out and achieving, but I don't know, there's so much on, man. I'm just not. I'd rather rewatch The West Wing. Tackle.
Tackle.
William?
Yeah, her boobs in the thumbnail were not enough to get me interested. This was a teaser trailer. And there was no substance. I have no idea what's going on. So, tackle.
I love how the gay guy is the one who pointed out the boobs in the thumbnail.
I just want you to know that I didn't know this was Kirsten Dunst until now.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't really look much like her.
No.
Third.
She's not
trailer.
Kissing anyone upside down.
Way to step on it, Justin.
Third did I step on trailer.
The... I did again. It again.
Best pod ever.
Oh, I'm just going to do it then. All right. The third trailer is Trolls.
We're so good at this. 7 years. We're so good at this.
Well, to be fair, this is the first year we've had. year we've had a live Drops guy. So William is making this show better, but exposing how terrible I am.
Well, the problem is just a little inside baseball here. Normally, your Drops guy is within a sight line of the other host. But since we record this on Discord audio only, I can't signal to them when I'm going to do shit. So I have to just guess and pray and hope for the best.
So we need to start webcamming this, is what you're saying.
It is a lot like praying, yeah. I.e. it doesn't get shit.
Third trailer.
Trolls Magical. World Tour is the sequel to the movie... The sequel we didn't know we needed to the movie we didn't know we needed. So I never thought there'd be a Trolls animated movie in my life. And then I saw it, and it suffers from Indiana Jones syndrome, where Anna Kendrick's main character does nothing to solve the plot the whole time. And I didn't really like the movie. Maybe Daniel, did you like the first Trolls?
I gave it a solid C+.
Okay, that's fair. Now let's get to this trailer. I think this trailer, there's a lot I really, really like about this trailer. I like the premise of the six strings. I like the idea that the strings each represent a different type of music. I just think that's a very creative world building, and I wish it had been done with the first one. So I think this takes the premise and it makes it better than the original. The bet that there's a bunch of different trolls, there's a bunch of different species. I think this is much more appealing than the first. However, I have a really big fucking problem with this story, the execution of the premise. So again, I love the premise. The execution is my problem. The idea that somebody is trying to destroy all the other types of music, and the idea that the evil person is the rock troll, like the rock and roll troll. And that the good person is the pop troll. If there's any style of music that's trying to destroy other styles of music, it's pop. So this, I don't want to say I'm offended by this, but is this just my inner punk coming out? Especially because they made the rock troll look punk. Like I look, I see the thumbnails here, and I saw like the part where they're like, they're the six different strings. And then the rock troll shows up and starts playing the fucking hard rock. And I'm like, yeah, this is fucking awesome. And then they're like, by the way, this is the villain. And I'm like, fuck you.
Isn't that your lot in life?
I know. This
character's amazing. And they're the villain.
Yes. Okay. Yes. This is my life in a fucking nutshell. So as much as I appreciate all the things about this, and I probably still will end up seeing this, I have to tackle this on principle.
Tackle.
Yeah, very dispassionate tackle, Daniel.
I'm going to see this. Let's not kid ourselves. I think it would have been better, though, if the villain was like the classical music string, and it's sort of like, you know, the world's forgotten about us, we want our revenge, or something, like anything other than the rock troll being the villain, really. Even if the country western was the villain, like, that'd be a little better or something. But so that's a little weird. But overall, I thought this music was better than the first Trolls, and I thought it looked fairly funny. And I thought the writing for the first Trolls was the strong part, the music was the weak part. And but the writing, I don't mean the plotting. I mean the literal jokes and the
dialogue. Yeah, because you knew what I was going to say.
Yeah, but the plotting was bad. Yes. You know, sort of soft hug.
Hug.
Daniel, okay, couldn't they have done something like it's a competition between the six strings every year or something, rather than like one's trying to kill the other five strings?
Something, and then like one of them finds a way to cheat to win the contest, or I don't know, something.
Yeah, or like they have there's a hip-hop troll at the end or whatever. Like, they could have been like, why is there no hip-hop string, and like a new string is created or something.
Well, they find the combination of the strings creates new genres.
Yeah.
That's probably what they're going to do at the end anyway, but...
Yeah. William?
No. This seems like maybe we're trying to take all the music biopics and make something with... mix it with Trolls and make something kid-friendly. I don't know. It doesn't interest me, and the music seems better than the original Trolls, which I agree with, but I don't know that this... Maybe if I'm super bored on a flight to somewhere, this would be something I'd put on so I could try to pass out and pass the time. But no.
Could you imagine if you're super high watching this?
That would probably give me a permanent nightmare. So I think.
Wait, you mean his flight goes to a really high elevation?
Yes, that's what I mean, mm-hmm. Mr. Straight Edge. That's what I mean.
Tackle. Final trailer.
Ready or Not is a horror movie about this woman who marries into a, I guess they're a board game family. I don't know. They're like a board game magnate family. And then at the night of her wedding, they make her play a game. And they make her play hide and seek, but then they have to kill her to keep their family going. Like, if they don't kill her, she's like their sacrifice. And if they don't kill her, something bad happens to their family. I know that all sounds ridiculous.
It's a tale as old as time.
Yeah, song as old as rhyme. It all sounds ridiculous. And I feel like Barry Allen in the Snyder cut of Justice League in that trailer where he's like, stop right there. I'm in. I enjoyed watching this. I thought...
Really?
I thought the over-the-topness was great. I thought the premise was interesting. I liked the idea that... I'm glad they put in there that the husband's trying to help her escape, although it seems kind of weird he didn't tell her about this before they got married. Like, maybe they could have just ran away and eloped somewhere. Like, if they had eloped to Bermuda, would they have found her and forced her to play hide and seek in Bermuda? Is that the sequel? Is that the spinoff? Like, I don't know. There seems like some holes in this, but I don't know. This looks like it could be a fun time at the movies. I'm in. Hug.
Hug.
What happened if they got common law married? Like, do they have to go through a wedding ceremony? I don't... Whatever.
This After 7 years, they randomly show up at her house and force her to play hide and seek.
Time go seek time. This movie looks awful. Awful.
False.
I appreciate the originality of it, though, so points there, but looks awful. Tackle.
Tackle.
Oh, you know another thing I appreciate about this? That they didn't just go to the Fugees. Like, the soundtrack actually worked. They could have done the Fugees. Ready or not, here I come, gonna find you. But they didn't go that cliche route. They actually use interesting music, so I appreciate that as well. William?
I appreciated that the trailer eventually ended.
This is Get Out for women, so no.
Tackle.
I mean, it could be Get Out for women, except the husband's on her side, so I don't think it's as malevolent as
Or is he? Twist!
God damn it, William. Stop ruining movies for me.
She's going to be the one who he has to kill her at the end or something. Like, he's going to be the last family member. He's going to turn on her. You know, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. Of course, everything's about everyone being a victim nowadays,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. I know where this movie's
going. I think
we should
talk about that in Life on the Midside.
Take a good look around. Does life really suck? I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you'll throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah.
So since I've come back from when Zack Snyder did that director's cut weekend in Pasadena, I've been more involved in the Release the Snyder Cut movement on Twitter, trying to help out with that, trying to get more eyes on that. So, you know, hopefully the Snyder Cut of Justice League can be released.
Becoming a meme lord.
Yeah, I tried to become a meme lord, but they don't fuck that. This is part of the thing. This is what I don't understand, right? Like, it's been proven being a meme lord. I'm glad you said that. I didn't say that to you, right? Because I literally said to people in the movement, I go, we need memes. I'm going to become the meme lord of Release the Snyder Cut. I literally said that. It's funny we're on the same page. But that's the point, is like a lot of it didn't catch on, even though I came up with some pretty good memes. I mean, that meme of It's Always Sunny, where he's looking at the Snyder Cut, and it's the really pretty woman, and then the fat woman sits up, and it's Justice League, and he says, sit back down. Like, that's a great meme, but it didn't catch on any steam. Because I've become very disillusioned with this. Because it seems like, rather than focusing on the fact that they're asking for a movie, it's like, hey, you own this, I want to see it. You know, Daniel, I'm very cognizant of what you were saying about property, right? These things are owned by the studios, and you're asking for their property. Rather than focusing on that, they'd rather turn themselves into victims of WB, of Disney, and the culture in general. Most of what they're talking about in regards to Release the Snyder Cut is what I see as something that's very negative and very, you know, toxic is the key word a lot of people that are critiquing them are using, and they hate that word. But it's all about like this victim culture. Like, we're not getting the art we want to see because of this, because of how terrible it is and how terrible the culture is. And it's interesting the way to me that they're externalizing and they're making these things about the world around them rather than what they want and what they value, and celebrating what they value. And it's very ironic to me that it's an individualist filmmaker and they're coming from this perspective. And then likewise, William, on our review of Game of Thrones on the Patreon exclusive episode, you can go find that on the patreon.com/midside or the midside.com/patreon, only available to Patreon subscribers. We talked about how Yaron Brook on his show talks about somehow he saw Game of Thrones as romantic. And then Midsider Conrad listened to our show. And then as he was listening to Yaron's show, he was talking to me. And he was telling me the things Yaron was saying, and we were talking about it. And something clicked with me. And I realized he was coming from almost this victim perspective, where the reason he sympathizes with characters on Game of Thrones and thinks they're being romantic is, and he doesn't see it as naturalism. And in the same sense, I know he was a big fan of The Wire and didn't see that as naturalism, even though it's set in the most naturalistic city in the world, in the country, Baltimore.
The city that reads.
The city that reads. I'm shaking my head. Is because he sees them as romantic, but the world as forcing them to not be romantic, because the world is so irrational, it limits their number of choices, so therefore the characters can't be romantic. So it's like he's finding romanticism within these stories because he seems to be externalizing the moral responsibility, because they lose their moral responsibility because of how irrational the world is. So those are my thoughts, and I wanted to see if you guys can help me tease those out more, or see what I'm thinking about here, if you have any idea of what I'm talking about or if I'm just talking crazy now. Because I think this is a really important point. Because I think if you're, you know, in general, like if you're going to support Snyder and it's a filmmaker who's individualist, I don't see how you can support him and his films by acting in this way that's antithetical to what the point of his movies are. So I think this is a really important tension to tease out.
Yeah, just to fill people in, you should totally check out our discussion on Game of Thrones. But, you know, one of the things we pointed out is that early on, characters' choices were well set up and their choices had consequences, which is an important part of a romantic story. But there were tons of other things that crushed that sort of pseudo-romanticism and turned it back into naturalism. So you should definitely check out the podcast.
Right, William, to better say what you're saying is it's very similar to The Walking Dead, right, where The Walking Dead has elements of we're seeing these different characters make choices, and the characters are very well-defined, right? You have a diverse cast of characters. Yeah. And I don't mean that in the minority demographic way. I just mean these characters all have different personalities and values and philosophies. But The Walking Dead concretizes it more in the zombies are what's making the world irrational and making it impossible for these people to make rational choices and make actual choices because their lives are limited by that. So the world's irrational. In Game of Thrones, they end up concretizing that as the wheel being everyone always looking for power and that creating this society that is the same as the zombies in The Walking Dead. Would you characterize it? Would you say it's a fair characterization?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think what's interesting about that is a lot of what modern art does, and Game of Thrones seems to be this, although I've only seen a few episodes in my life, is we set up an emergency situation, and then we put all these characters in an emergency situation, and then none of them act morally. So maybe what's being responded to is the sort of the kernels of acting morally in these emergency situations. I don't know. But I think that's what makes Atlas Shrugged all the more fascinating and prescient, almost, is it takes this concept of the emergency situation, society crumbling, and turns it on its head and basically says, it is because of your choices that we're in this emergency situation. And it's not something that's a natural state of the world. It's something that you created. And I think that's what a lot of these shows lack, but it might be the thing that some people are latching on to. I'm not the Snyder Cut people, obviously, but the objectivists.
Well, yeah. Well, the thing that I think what you're saying is very well taken. I'm just sort of working backwards from what you're saying here. The issue I'm having is they externalize it to the real world, and they see these these fictional emergency worlds. They see the real world the same way. But with what makes Atlas Shrugged so powerful, your point is very well taken. Because Atlas Shrugged's focus isn't on, oh, how the world is limiting these people's choices, right? Because you could see how the same novel could be written, all about how Hank Reardon's business can't get off the ground. And you could over and over again show Hank Reardon making decisions to try and do things, but they just don't matter because the irrational world fucks him over, right? That's not the focus of it. The focus of it is on Hank Reardon learning his internal journey to learn what he needs to do to be rational in the world. So it takes the world as a given. This is the world you exist in. You must learn about yourself and your values and how you can best do that in the world as it exists. And I think that these stories aren't doing that. They're focusing more on the world rather than the characters and how what they can learn and their choices. And then I think people are taking that into the real world and they're saying, oh, what matters more is that I'm a victim here of this irrational world, then what can I do to forward my values in this world?
I see. Yeah, that's a very seductive thing because it relieves you of the consequences of your choices, or it relieves you of the burden of having to say very abstractly, to provide for yourself. And what I mean there is the burden of you making choices and furthering your values, and you can simply say, well, it's just not possible because the world is against me, or it's not possible because this group is against me, or these groups are against me. So what's the point in trying?
Right. And that's a perfect way of putting it. And seductive was the word we had said pre-show that I was looking for. And I'm glad you said that. Yeah, it's very seductive because as I see the Snyder Cut movement too, the Snyder Cut movement, over and over again, they focus on finding people on Twitter or on social media or in the world who say negative things about Zack Snyder and Batman versus Superman and just attacking them and telling them how they're wrong. And it makes it so they're not going anywhere. They're not getting any momentum for what their goal is because they're really not focused on getting the movie released. What they're focused on is pointing out how they can never get the movie, which becomes self-defeating. And I do think on a certain level, it's what you said, it's seductive because focusing on that makes it so they have a really safe niche. And the safe niche is, I want this thing that is superior to what everyone else wants, but I know I can't get it because everyone else is fucked up. The world is fucked up. So they sit there in this niche where they can feel superior, but they know they can never succeed. So they never move from their feeling of superiority.
Justin, I think this is the new pseudo self-esteem. And what I mean by that is, if you can externalize this and make it all about a victim hierarchy, then you don't have to do all the hard work of building your own individual character and take responsibility for your own individual happiness. Because you can always point outside of yourself and say, look, I'm a victim.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, I agree with you 100%.
Look at it from an economics point of view, interestingly, which is that we define the capital of this game as victimhood. So the more victimhood you collect, the richer you are in this game. So now, what is the incentive for them to actually succeed at getting what they are purporting to be their value, which is releasing the Snyder Cut? Because if they actually get that release, they lose their victimhood coins, and they don't get them anymore. So there's actually a weird incentive created where it's better for these people to continue to be victims and to play up their victimhood than it is for them to actually get the thing that they purport to value.
Right, because then they lose the perch they're on, as I was saying.
Yes, they lose their victimhood coins.
Right, and then they actually have to start trying.
Yeah. So from an economics perspective, it's weird. Man.
I value the movie, therefore I want to see it. It will make my life better.
Yeah, but what are you going to do with all your victim coins?
Well, and that's why I find it interesting, and I find it a little dangerous.
It's the 2019 version of internet money.
Oh, 100% is the 2019 version. It'd be interesting if South Park did that again. But that's why I find it interesting and a little bit dangerous that someone like Yaron Brooke will say Game of Thrones is romantic in any capacity, or say The Wire is good in any capacity. This is something that has been bugging me for years about why him and a few other objectivists who were considered quote unquote notable said they liked The Wire so much. I'll watch anything and I'll sit through most things, right? I could get through maybe two seasons of The Wire and I don't even care what happens in season 3 and 4. That's how bad and naturalistic it was.
It is honestly one of the worst shows I've ever watched in my life. I'm sorry if there's anyone out there in our audience who likes it, but the first episode, I fell asleep multiple times trying to watch it, and then pushing myself through, I just did not give a crap about any of the characters, and it just all seemed naturalistic garbage, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, yeah, and McNulty was sort of the one character who I sort of liked, but even then, that was about destroying the typical American rugged individualist hero, the John McClane hero. He was that hero, except he was a drunk, and he didn't have a good relationship with his wife and his kids and everything. It was just, but again, if you see that as not him who's the problem, you see that as the world's the problem forcing him to be that way. And I think that's, I just think it's dangerous, and it's scary to me. It's scary to me. It was sort of, this conversation with Midsider Conrad was kind of an eye-opening moment to me. And was I naive before? Did you guys see this before? Or am I crazy?
False dichotomy.
Both.
Bro. So both. I've sort of seen it for a little while. Maybe we just haven't made it explicit, and that's why it's interesting. Sometimes you can observe things, but it doesn't become quote-unquote real until you concretize it and put it out. You know, you externalize it. Yeah, oddly. But don't be afraid, Justin. There's no reason to be afraid. No reason to have fear over this. Just go on doing your thing, pushing the Snyder Cut, pushing the Midside, promoting your values in the world, and all will be right.
Promoting individualism, promoting everything that Rand said was amazing, right?
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm in life on the Midside, I talk more off the cuff. And I'm more relaxed and more conversational. I mean, I am pretty much that way on the show. But here it's more I'm thinking through things and it's observations. And you get what I'm trying to say, right?
There's nothing to fear but never seeing the Snyder Cut.
That's true. William, do you have any final thoughts or reflections on this?
Well, I just want to, just to close everything out, like, if you like we talked about on the Game of Thrones podcast, if you find something in naturalistic art that you like, that's great, right? It's about mining for values, especially in today's culture when like everything is naturalism. But to misidentify it is not helping you, right? Like the reason I liked the early seasons of Game of Thrones is exactly because of the rich characters and their choices actually mattering, which is a romantic element. And that's cool, right? But I wouldn't call the show overall romantic, right? I wouldn't kind of fake myself out and say it was a great show because it was romantic. Like, no, that you're not going to help yourself identify good art in the future if you don't take the time to introspect and figure out what it is you like about it.
Right. And to reinforce what you're saying is kind of a final point here. It's all about your own values and what you think is best for your life. So the identification is important because it'll help you identify better things in the future. And when we're identifying and we're talking in these categories, we don't mean to say everything's 100% naturalistic and 100% romantic. Even a lot of the more romantic stuff has some elements of naturalism in it because we're living in a mixed culture. So yeah, maybe Game of Thrones was 80-20 or so, or 90-10 or something like that. I speak in clear categories because I'm trying to make a rhetorical point to get people to think a certain way. It's not that everything is all or nothing. And I think, especially if you take on this victim approach and you externalize in that way, you see everything as all or nothing. And that's where the collectivism starts to come in, right? You're either in our group or you're not in our group because you're either adding to this culture that's victimizing me or you're fighting it. All right, I think that's a good way to end this episode. So what did we learn this trip, William?
I learned that large bouncing breasts are unethical.
Daniel?
I learned that I'm missing out on a lot of Juneteenth parties, apparently, that I'm not getting an invite to. Maybe it's because my skin's a little light. I don't know. But I'm not white, people. Please remember that. I am not white. Justin?
I learned that suicide rates are directly proportional to how many people want to fuck you because Asian women have the lowest suicide rates.
Oh my God. Okay, well, we hope you learned something other than those things this week. Tell us on all the social medias at the Midside, but particularly Twitter or Instagram. Those would be great. You can go to themidside.com/podcast and listen to all the past episodes, including episodes of the Snyder series, as well as Nolan Notes, where we look at those movies. Those are all excellent.
We have a new podcast. Nolan Notes coming up in July.
Oh, baby.
Ooh, look at that. And yeah, you can also go to themidside.com/store to get the merch. We love the merch. And subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Google Play, where you can leave us a 5-star review. That really helps us. Thanks to Liberty.me, our libertarian friends, for syndicating us, and Patreon.com/TheMidside, where you can go and give us a couple bucks. It helps us keep the lights on until we figure out another way to monetize this show. And then always, as always, please tell a friend about the show. That really does. It significantly helps. So as you're planning up your Independence Day parties and thinking about the soundtrack that you're going to put on in the background, nothing says independence. Nothing says American individualism like putting on an episode of The Midside at your July 4th celebration. So until next time, we love you.
This concludes your journey into The Midside. I'm Justin Emelzneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a Juneteenth. So how much longer until we start saying certain male characters are too manly in video games? Maybe their balls are too big. We have to shrink their package. They're showing too many abs.
They're showing too much aggression, really. We're going to have to cut down on the aggression in these
games. They're all going to become Peter Pan-like characters instead of muscly dudes.
Maybe we replace the guns with paintball. That'll be better.